So our next speaker is Gerald Sachs. He's the great expert on computability and needs no introduction.
Thank you. I never met Turing, but I knew some of his students and colleagues, so there are many stories I could tell about them. But some, of course, are not appropriate. Some are, but I think I'll save them for the end of the talk at this time.
Inappropriate, wasn't it?
So you're the judge.
Parikh, I'll do the jokes. I've noticed it's and I'm happy about it, for reasons that you'll see. I've noticed that it's not really possible to talk about Turing without mentioning Gödel. And my talk has to do with hierarchies, and Turing certainly anticipated the importance of hierarchies in computability theory. I'll leave it at that. Okay, so collapsing sentences has to do with the celebrated argument Gödel invented to show that the continuum hypothesis, in fact, the generalized continuum hypothesis, holds in L. I remember trying to learn this argument as a student. The only available source at that time was Princeton Annals Monograph Number 1, the orange books, on Gödel's work in set theory. And it's a beautifully written book. It's very easy to read. You just go line by line, absorbing definitions, verifying arguments. But I don't recall a single intuitive remark in the book. That was okay with me. After all, I'm a recursion theorist. But he certainly aroused my interest with this argument. And I remember reading it over and over. It was easy to check. And I guess somebody called it a collapsing argument. It did seem to be that, and it arouses my interest to this day. Maybe this sounds ridiculous, but I think it's more important mathematically than the incompleteness theorem. Its influence continues. I mean, it's used by all sorts of people, of course, in set theory, but also in so-called higher recursion theory, and also in model theory. Jensen introduced it in model theory when he did his wonderful proof that the gap 2 conjecture holds in L. And in other words, he constructed some models. He constructed some hard-to-find models or structures. He solved a model theory question of the type, does there exist a model such that blah, blah, blah. And he did it by using Gödel's collapsing argument. When I get into the slides, I don't have that many actually, don't worry. I'll call it a condensation argument. This term was introduced by Jensen and Kopp in a very important paper about what goes on in L. Okay, so let's actually look at a slide. Well, I guess this has decided not to work. The laser part works, but wait.
No,
I don't. It's this or nothing. Yeah, try this. Is that really a USB slot?
I guess.
No, I think it goes that way, yeah. Okay. Okay, we give it one more try. Okay. Yeah. All right, so we give up on the clicker, that we'll try this instead. Ah. All right, so girdle condensation. So I'll review things a bit. Let me say where I'm headed here. I'm too interested in building a certain models with the help of L, in other words. I think Jensen introduced the possibility of settling various model theoretic questions if you assume V equals L, and I guess that's my inspiration. So I have a to sigma n substructure of L. That simply means that H is a subset of L, and any sigma n sentence in the language, excuse me, any sigma n sentence in the language of set theory, parameters in H, is true in H if and only if it's true in L. Okay, and then there's the condensing map. And it's defined by recursion, right? X is an element of H, and M of X is simply the set of M of Y's, or Y a member of X. And what that does is it collapses H. H most likely is an intransitive set. It collapses H to a transitive set, sometimes called the transitive collapse. And there it is. And so the H and M of H are isomorphic, except one is transitive and the other is probably not. Okay. And so the essential result of Gödel is that any such MH is an initial segment of L. And in fact, from what I'm going to talk about, N will always be equal to 1. This is true even with N equal to 1. I like N equal to 1 because you can actually visualize every little thing that's going on behind the scenes. Okay. So, since the title of the talk was Collapsing Sentences, I have to tell you a little bit. So this is about infinitary logic. So infinitary logic, as the term is used here, is just a kind of straightforward extension of ordinary first-order logic. The only change really is you can now have a conjunction of any length you like. In other words, any set of formulas can be conjuncted or disjuncted. There's one very important proviso. Quantifier prefixes are a finite length. If you allow infinite length, then you're getting really into second order logic. Okay. And a related proviso is a formula can only have finitely many free variables. Yeah. So there's a price you pay for this, I guess. You have to kiss goodbye pre-next normal form. That's gone. Okay. So some definitions, some minor definitions here. One direction. So a little bit of notation. L lambda omega is the set of well-formed formulas of rank less than lambda. The omega, the little omega, is a reminder that you can't have, I think that's my phone, actually. No, I think that you can't have infinite strings of quantifiers. All right, so here's an important notion. A fragment Z is a set of well-formed formulas such that Z is closed under all the usual finitary formation rules of first-order logic. So they're finitary, they're very simple, you know them. But there is one important requirement. Every formula, every subformula of a formula of Z is a formula of Z. So that's sort of saying, like, That's analogous to saying a set is transitive. Okay. Now, the axioms and rules of infinitary logic are, in essence, the same as those of first-order logic. I mean, those rules are all finitary. There's really only one infinitary rule. There it is. If you have a deduction of f sub I for every I, then, in fact, you have a deduction of the conjunction. Right? So you might call that the infinite conjunction, or I should really say arbitrary conjunction introduction rule. So you're very close. You're very close to just ordinary first order logic, but then it turns out there are big differences, especially when it comes to building models, as we'll see in a moment. So let's suppose we have a fragment Z. And we have a subset of that fragment Z called T, T for theory. So T is complete, the usual sense, and a little bit more. In other words, every formula of the fragment or its negation belongs to T. But the little bit more, if a disjunction belongs to T, then you certainly want one of its components in T. Right there. In other words, if you're asserting a disjunction, you better make sure that you can assert one of its components. So this all goes very simply. All right, so there are some facts here, which were proved, long ago by various people. Suppose you have a fragment, and you have a theory T. So fact one, if T is countable and consistent, then it has a model. And you can prove this in the usual Hankin style. Now, by consistent, I mean what it means. Consistent means what you think it means, right? There's no contradiction from T using the rules and axioms described on the previous slide. So it's just of course, it's a much stronger notion of consistency than you have in ordinary first-order logic. But the following notion, finitary consistency, turns out to be useful. So here, no finite deduction from T yields a contradiction. That doesn't rule out the possibility that an infinitely long deduction will still give you a contradiction, but no finite deduction does. By finite deduction, I mean the number of lines in the demonstration, the deduction, are finite. Of course, one line could be infinitely long, since we have infinitely long formulas. So it's only finite in length. All right. So fact two, if T is finitarily consistent and complete, then it's consistent. So it sounds like I've pulled a fast one. But I haven't. And if T is countable, finitarily consistent and complete, then T has a model. Now, actually, two follows from three. If you look at three, essentially, if you just dive in and do a Hankin argument, it'll work. In other words, the argument will only have countably many steps, and you only have to preserve finite consistency at each step. And you can do that. And at the end, since what you have is still finitely consistent, and so you have a structure the way Hankin would give you a structure. So how about, that's fact three. How do you get fact two, that finitary consistency and completeness actually gives you full consistency? Well, the way to do it is to generically collapse the universe to something countable, so T becomes countable. So in that universe, T has a model by fact three. Hence, in that university, it's consistent. But then it's got to be consistent in the universe you start with, since it's small. So that's the way to do it. That's not the way it was originally done. All right, so how about condensing a theory? Suppose I start with a countable L now. So that my language, my stock of primitive symbols now is assumed to be countable, and of course I need that. And I have some fragment, T, and it's best to think of T as some huge uncountable thing, because that's what we're trying to deal with here. So I have a huge T which is consistent in the very strong sense, and it's consistent and complete, and that's happening in some fragment Z, which of course has to be huge. All right. So I build a sigma 1 substructure of V, calling it H, and I put T into H as well, and I apply the condensing map. Now there's an annoying assumption, namely that the collapse of Z is a subset of Z. Z will also be in H because T is. The collapse of Z is contained in Z. In every application I've made, you get that for free, but still it has to be said. So here's a theorem. When you do the collapse, you get an initial segment of T. In other words, the collapse of a theory is an initial segment of the theory. So H could be countable, right? That's doable. H could be countable, in which case you're always getting a countable initial segment of T. So these collapses of a great big T to countable initial segments of T, it turns out, will tell us a great deal about T. I forgot to say, in general, when you collapse something, it loses any important, it usually loses any important property of that. In other words, you can't get away with murder with the collapsing argument. You can't collapse something with property P and assume you're going to get something with property P. This is almost always false, in case you haven't had that experience. Okay. So I have a sketch here, a quick sketch of the the proof of the last theorem. It's pretty straightforward. So but I think for lack of time, I won't do it. I'll just say that's really the whole proof right there. And so I'll just make the case it's very easy to do this argument. It is, well, it's easy to write down a false argument of this thing, but a false proof. But this is a correct proof. It's the kind of argument which is very simple, but if you overlook some trivial detail, then you've made a big mistake. All right. So I want to introduce the notion of stability. Yeah. I'm trying to address a problem. This talk today is taken from a larger work, which hopefully I will never finish, about if you have one of these big theories, in general, there's no hope of finding a model. So the stability notion is part of a surge of concepts and assumptions that might help to produce a model. The only thing you can say in general is, if T is countable, it's got a model. If T has size olive 1, and it's a subset of L omega 1 omega, in other words, all the sentences in T are of countable length, and there's only olive 1 many of them, then long ago it was shown by people like Julian Knight and others that it has a model. And then that can be stretched a bit. If you have an ordinal lambda which is less than olive 2, and that bounds the length of all the sentences in T, and the number of sentences in T is still olive 1 cardinality, then you can sort of stretch the old results and you can still get a model. All right. But beyond that, it's a black hole. I mean, so I've been working on trying to looking at the case when T has size all of 2. In other words, T is the fragment is the fragment Z in this case is L omega 2 omega. All right. All right. So here's a definition. So T prime is a countable condensate of T. Countable condensate of T. In other words, you started with a hull. It was a countable sigma 1 substructure of V. T belonged to the hull, and you collapsed it. So when you collapsed it, you've got a countable theory. And in fact, we know by theorem A, you got a countable initial segment of T. But this definition doesn't care about that. Now, then comes S of T prime, the set of all n types of T prime. That has to be defined syntactically, because you can't define types here semantically, because you don't know that any models exist. So types are defined syntactically. All right, so here's the definition. Moderately stable. You look at every countable condensate T prime of T, and the set of types for that theory is countable. So by theorem A, that's really saying you look at a typical, so to speak, countable initial segment of T, and the types over that countable initial segment of the theory, that set of types is countable. Okay. All right, so there's a notion of admissible set. An admissible set is essentially a transitive set closed under trivial operations, and let's just say satisfying sigma 1 replacement. Okay. So if you start with any set X, there's at least one. Okay. So here's theorem B. Now, it says T is moderately stable if and only if you go up in the sky to big T, take the least admissible set with it as a member, and then look at the set of all types over T. It itself is a member of that least admissible set containing T. Yeah. No time to explain why that's intuitively reasonable, but it is. Yeah, so now I elaborate here on what that means. In other words, when I say the set of all types, it means there's a set in the admissible closure of T, call it W, and it's a set of n types. And from T, you can deduce that for all x1 through xn, every type P of x1 through xn is a member of W. In other words, it's more or less a proof that a certain object is a proof in the sense, there's a proof in the sense of L infinity omega that the set of types, all types, is actually there in A1 of T. So it's true. They're really there as syntactical objects. How you get from the definition of moderate stability to this theorem. In other words, moderate stability could have been defined this way, sort of up in the sky, so to speak. But I think the definition would have been incomprehensible. But in the end, this is what you want to know. Okay. So I'm not going to prove that. Okay. So, what theorem C says, with the assumption of moderate stability, you can prove that T actually has types. And that's a very modest first step in trying to build a model of T. In other words, it would be insane to try and build a model of big T without knowing whether T has any types at all. whether anything exists. In other words, I say you pay a price for inflammatory lighting, which I said earlier. You don't know that models are there, and they're usually not, but you don't even know if types are there. Okay, so I guess I won't prove that. Though here's the proof. It's fairly short, as you can see. It's really a sketch. All right. It goes back to an early result. I'll just maybe to pique your interest. This is sort of a hyped up version of something from early descriptive set theory, which had an effective version as follows. If you had a hyperarithmetic set which happened to be countable, someone told you it's countable, which is a kind of non-constructive assumption, you get a constructive conclusion, namely, all the reals in the set are hyperarithmetic individually. So this is a sort of far-flung generalization of that. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Any questions for the speaker? So another round of applause, and we should proceed directly to the next speaker.
I think this is mine.
I think that's yours.